Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast, which offers up cutting-edge libertarian commentary on politics, culture, and ideas. Subscribe to us at iTunes and never miss an episode. Today, my guests are Reason Magazine's editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Nick.
And Reason editor-at-large, Matt Welch. Hey, Matt.
Hello.
We're going to talk about politics. We're going to talk about the politics or lack of politics at last night's Super Bowl halftime show and advertisements. Donald Trump's travel ban and continuing issues with that. His comments about America being quite not so innocent. And the confirmation fights for his picks for education and justice that are coming up this week. And whatever else comes into our minds. So here we go. I assume that all three of us watched the Super Bowl, or at least good chunks of it, or at least the halftime show. It was a great game, but politics was all over the Super Bowl. Several of the ads, especially one from Anheuser-Busch and 84 Lumber, were objectively pro-immigrant. Conservative commentator talking about Lady Gaga, who included a snippet from the Pledge of Allegiance before she jumped off the edge of a stadium into the crowd, which was pretty fantastic. She said that Lady Gaga omitted the words, of course, omitted the words under God from the Pledge of Allegiance, which was false. Alt-right, and I don't know how late you guys stayed up, but alt-right, Obergruppenfuhrer, Richard Spencer, claimed that the Patriots were the whitest team in the NFL, and that's why they won. And then he posted a GIF of Tom Brady after the game kissing his Brazilian, I assume a Nazi science experiment from Brazil, supermodel wife Gisele Bündchen, and actually writing, "For the white race, it's never over." My first question, and Matt, I'll go to you first. My first question is just really, people really are just douchebags, aren't they?
That's the first question of every Reason podcast.
Every podcast for everything. I loved the, I thought that the Super Bowl itself as a document that was on television was so wonderfully not as political as everyone was trying to make it. And that goes down to the Anheuser-Busch ad, which it's remarkable to me that that became like an immigration issue when it's just like a total, you know, corporate myth-making BS about and beautiful and lovely. I adored that commercial. But it's just like, hey, you know, we were founded by this guy, and here's his hard scrabble, classically American story that's rooted in German immigration in the 19th century, which is very interesting. But like, that has really not a whole lot to do with contemporary immigration politics.
And so, who owns Anheuser-Busch now? Is it Belgium's InBev something?
It's like the InBev thing. There's now just two companies left in most crappy beer making in the world. It's a duopoly, Nick. It's a classic duopoly.
God, where have I heard that? Yeah.
No, but like Lady Gaga's was very subtle. I mean, part of me was going, I was watching it over at Anthony Fisher's house. I was like hoping that she would come out in the full burqa with the eye slits and just like go for it. But then I was kind of happy that she didn't, because we're demanding so much totally relevant contemporary politics and everything that it's kind of nice to play it subtly for once and not have it be as dreary as I'm sure the Academy Awards is going to be next week. So I like the fact that everyone got really pregnant with politics before this, and that there actually wasn't that much of it going in, with the possible exception of that.
Yeah, do you want to finish that metaphor by saying we got really pregnant with politics, but then it turned out to be an ectopic pregnancy, or perhaps we had an abortion of politics, Matt Welch?
Thank you. No. The only abortion is Richard Spencer.
For the white race, it's never over. I mean, that's like, I hope they're bringing him in as a script consultant on the third season of Man in the High Castle. Catherine, what was your sense of things? Did you watch the Super Bowl? And I ask that because you're a woman, and I know that women don't like sports. This is what I've been told.
I did not watch the Super Bowl, so stereotype confirmed. And I instead just watched Lady Gaga on YouTube this morning, which was explained to me the conversation I had this morning as I was walking my son to school. A man came up on the street corner to chat with us briefly, and he said, "You know, last night was such an impressive display of athleticism." And I was like, it was the Super Bowl. Isn't that kind of the point? And he was like, no, I'm talking about Lady Gaga. And yeah, I should note here that this conversation happened at the corner of 17th and Q, which is probably one of the gayer corners in Washington, D.C. But I was like, I better check it out. And he's right. It was one of the more impressive displays of athleticism I've seen in a while.
Could you imagine, you know, Elvis or Robert Plant or Janis Joplin? I mean, I can imagine them jumping off the stadium because they want to commit suicide in some kind of drug-fueled haze. But, I mean, that was like, that's one hell of a, you know, move over Fast and Furious. Like, we've got a new action hero.
Yeah. I mean, I also was somewhat relieved at the lack of politics, and I liked that she made it explicit. You know, she sat down at that piano and said, I'm just here to make everybody feel good. That's the best I can do. And I think that's the difference between the stakes pre-election and post-election, right? I mean, Beyonce, great. Like, let's get in high dudgeon while potentially changes can still be made. Lady Gaga, here to soothe you through your misery of day 12 of the Donald Trump presidency.
As a, you know, if last year, I guess, Beyonce, of course, tried to resuscitate the Black Panther Party by explicitly wearing guerrilla warfare clothes and trying to command her army of followers to take up armed revolt, or at least that's what the right was saying. I have to say, as an Italian-American, I was disappointed that the former Miss Stephanie Germanotta did not break out some black shirts or some kind of Mussolini.
You think she had this? She had,
or just cover Dean Martin song.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, that would have been, yeah, something about a big pizza pie when the moon looks like a big pizza pie. You know, there was also, by the way, I'd say, well, I have like two things. I love, you know, I like football. I prefer college football, but I love halftime shows. And I thought this was great. And it to me, it was the best one since Prince's, which was also fantastic because he covered a bunch of other people's songs, and it was kind of like this great American songbook of great rock riffs. And even Bruce Springsteen's show from a few years ago, which I'm not a Springsteen fan, but it was like a rave up. And I think there's a politics to that. And I know Chuck Freund, who we all know and who wrote for us for a long time, has, you know, really, you know, informed my thinking on the ways in which popular culture is, you know, is a political statement. And, you know, what was on display with Lady Gaga last night, it's like, fuck you, Islamic terror. And, you know, like V.S. Naipaul, the writer, after 9/11, he said, I don't fear the hijackers because they can, you know, they can fly planes into buildings, but they can neither build planes nor buildings. And I kind of feel that way after last night, where it's just like, you know, I don't know how many millions of people or hundreds of millions of people watching. That was like, you know, when we were all scared of the Chinese Olympic opening ceremonies where, you know, a billion Chinese were beating drums in mechanical rhythm. Like, no, we've got a better pop culture because we have a better culture.
USA.
Sorry, that was very stirring,
yeah.
Nick.
No. But it's more. Yeah, but it's better than the U.S. Right. And that's, you know, between that and the 84 lumber ad with the Mexicans trying to get in, you know, it's all good.
I've spent a lot of time in countries that either used to be totalitarian or are currently, and it's
and now you're currently living in Brooklyn, the first borough that will probably go totalitarian.
When Elizabeth Warren is named dictator for life, amazing how many conversations I've had with people, and this isn't me fishing for it. This is it washes over you of people describing their visceral reaction to the freedom of especially American popular culture and how that inspired them. In many cases, it inspired them in complete opposite ways of the political message that was intended. You know, like the way the Rage Against the Machine is consumed in Havana, Cuba, is a little bit different than the Marxism of their lead singer. It is consumed in an anti-Marxist way. And I find that just really great and inspiring. And it also just shows that art is how it is the terms on which it is consumed is what matters, not necessarily the message that people feel like they're being broadcast. I mean, the way that Dallas was the television show was consumed in the East Block was not at all how the censors thought about this. This is true of Ernest Hemingway, of Jack London, who was a socialist in American terms, but he was consumed like a total individualist, anti-socialist when he was allowed to get through. And I just love all of that. And
no, there's nothing better than, you know, misappropriation or, misappropriation. That's one of the things that bugs the hell out of me about the attempts to pump the brakes on cultural appropriation, because there's only appropriation, misappropriation, reappropriation. What I was going to say about, there was I think it's a political statement before the game, which I found very moving. The NFL actually saluted Hall of Famers who had gone to historically black colleges, and a number of them were dead. And the NFL, I guess, actually, I'm not even sure about this, if the NFL integrated before the Major League Baseball or not. But, it had a couple of great early heroes like Marion Motley of the old Cleveland Browns. But it was kind of great because there were like guys, and Matt, given that we're a little bit closer in age and follow sports more than Catherine might, there were guys from, the misty edges of my childhood who were kind of walking out. And it was, it's thinking about something like the historically black colleges and also the role that professional sports has played in kind of changing, race relations in America. And I know you were the one who hipped me to Jackie Robinson's incredible book, his oral history of the integration of baseball. Baseball has done it. Talk a little bit about that, especially because baseball season is like essentially upon us.
Yeah, it's always very interesting to see what ways in which sports culture ends up kind of sporadically leading political culture and culture. I mean, baseball integrating was a very important precursor to the Civil Rights Act. I mean, baseball had 17 years kind of hard labor in doing this. And in the aforementioned Jackie Robinson book, Baseball Has Done It, which reminds us, among many other things, what just a pissed off dude Jackie Robinson was in a great way, including he was very mad at some of his fellow integrationists for not taking up the cause. But that book is a political document. It is intended to help shape and pass the Civil Rights Act. It came out at the exact same time. And it actually came out at the same time as arguably the most famous single history book about baseball, which is The Glory of Their Times by Lawrence Ritter, which is an oral history baseball era, 1910s and 20s, baseball. And it created this entire sort of nostalgia overlay. And reading those two side by side, and I say this as someone who absolutely adored The Glory of Their Times and read it 1,000 times, you can't help but escape. You can't escape the notion that The Glory of Their Times was a throwback to pre-integration baseball. It was a way to to wrap this all up with the gauze of nostalgia, kind of like in the way that in the mid-70s, a lot of movies like American Graffiti were sort of nostalgic of the time before of all these racial difficulties. So it is really interesting to see how sports kind of gets out in front of these things, allows us to have blunter conversations and more important conversations that eventually the rest of society and, of course, politics last gets into. And I think that's especially true on race.
Catherine, we also are kind of in the midst now that we're entering year 3000 of the Trump administration. And I apologize for not remembering if we just finished the third week or we're starting the third week of his presidency, which really is like year zero in the Cultural Revolution or the French Revolution. It's also almost to the day 100 years ago that one of the first major immigration acts, the 1917 Immigration Act, was signed, that which for the first time knocked out huge swaths of Europeans as well as Asians and other people. Trump has an executive ban or executive order that banned immigration from certain countries and all refugees. It's under court order. He lashed out at the judge in Washington State who issued a stay on that as a so-called judge. Do you worry, like, you know, that sets off a lot of people saying, like, oh, you know, rhetoric matters and he's not being presidential. Is that the issue here, or is it the actual policy, or is it impossible to kind of separate out the two?
We're certainly enjoying a great little civics lesson in balance of powers. And I think as long as everybody is just kind of getting salty with each other, but not actually disregarding the process, we're fine, right? Trump did something which he's, you know, more or less allowed to try and do. And the judiciary said, hold on, we don't think so. And the bureaucratic apparatus, for the most part, said, okay, we're going to adhere with the judge's stay until further notice. You know, I think there are a lot of people who totally understandably are reading Trump's tweets as, you know, maybe I won't be so indulgent of your foolishness next time, judges. But I'm not sure that's the only way to read it. Certainly the idea that he's setting up the judicial branch broadly for the fall, if and when there is some kind of terror attack on U.S. soil, is the most compelling explanation that I'm seeing here. Okay, a judge wants to oppose him, great, but that means now he's got someone to point finger at if something goes wrong during his presidency. And that's just rhetorical gamesmanship, right? That's just still classic Trump behavior. That's not quite the same thing as the erosion of the balance of powers yet. So I guess I'm reserving judgment, but not for too terribly much longer.
What does it say that, you know, in terms of letting refugees into the country since 1980, when a kind of new scheme administrative apparatus was put in place, we've had something like three people out of a couple million refugees, I expect, you know, prosecuted for terroristic activity. There were no deaths involved, and two of the three were guys who were trying to buy weapons here and ship them back to Iraq and were involved in an FBI kind of scam operation, you know, an entrapment operation. Why are we fixated with our terrorists or with our refugee policy now when it's like arguably one of the great successes of the past 30 years in American politics?
Well, I mean, it's obvious that we are in year, you know, 2025 or something like that, where the biggest source of terrorism is coming from Islamic extremism. And we see big examples of it several times a year at this point, either in this country or in Europe. And people are anxious about it and are trying to act on that anxiety and also in to give them the best benefit of the doubt as possible just for a moment. Saying, okay, so they haven't exactly explicitly gotten in on this refugee program, but they could. And so why don't we prevent this from happening before it happens? I think that is the best explanation for it. And you know, there's, as Justin Amash said, and when I interviewed him last week, the Congress who has been briefed on this by FBI officials and other people have said, the Homeland Security people have briefed Congress and told them, hey, we're not satisfied with the refugee vetting process. We think that there are holes in it that need to be fixed. So all of that speaks to, you can understand why it happens, but you can understand why people want to improve the refugee vetting thing. However, there's a lot of other behavior and comments, particularly from Trump and other people in the way that they talk about this issue, which indicates that they're not necessarily engaged in a good faith effort to try to fix a process that seems like it's working. The way that they have been conflating the refugee crisis in Europe with the one in America, that it really is not the same thing at all, speaks to that they're seizing on any opportunity to maximally reduce all immigration, including refugee immigration and other types. The fact that Trump's probably the most radical thing about this, besides the fact that it's an absolute ban of refugees, except on a case by cases for 4 months, when we've been admitting 200 a day for the last four decades. There's going to be none, except for case by case, or at least there is supposed to be none for 4 months. But the other radical thing about this is he's reducing the absolute number, the target number, from 110,000 to 50,000, and that's 50,000 going forward. And we're living at a time right now where the worldwide refugee population has gone bananas over the last 4 years. We've seen a huge spike in it. So it is just changing the overall nature of America as a refugee destination in a way. We've gone from leading the conversation globally, which we did under Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter and subsequent presidencies, to now leading the conversation away from refugees. And the only silver lining on this will be if Trump follows through on his discussions about creating safe zones for refugees in the Middle East itself. Mm-hmm. And I'm skeptical of that, but we'll see.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I've encountered a lot when you start talking about, the U.S. spent 15 years, engaging in regime change and occupation of Iraq. Maybe we owe the people who aided our, in my opinion, a stupid intervention, but we really should have these guys back, these men and women's back who tried to help us and are now threatened in their own homeland. But people are always like, well, why don't the countries around Syria take in Syrian refugees? And in fact, that's where the absolute lion's share, millions of refugees are in Turkey. Lebanon may have more Syrian refugees in it than it has actual Lebanese at this point. It's true. I think as a kind of beacon of light and as a refuge for people who are politically persecuted, religiously persecuted, et cetera, America should take a leading role. But in terms of like raw numbers, we're even at 110,000, which was more than the pre-average of 75,000 a year or target numbers. It's still a drop in the bucket. And it's a bucket that we kind of help put a fire hose in to fill up with all sorts of instability, particularly in the Middle East. Catherine, in a pre-Super Bowl interview yesterday, and this is where I guess to go back to the rhetoric of Trump, is he just trolling everybody? But O'Reilly was like, come on, Trump, say something bad about Putin. Like, why won't you say anything bad about Putin? He's a killer. And there's every reason to believe that Vladimir Putin was directly involved in the murder of journalists as well as political adversaries and whatnot. And Trump's answer, which again, the commentariat is flipping out over this. He said, oh, you think our country is so innocent? And of course, this comes on the heels of a drone strike in Yemen that was revealed to have killed a bunch of people, including an American girl. Is Trump right? And is it refreshing to actually have a president say, hey, you know what? We're not so innocent either.
He's right, but he's only using it to score rhetorical points in 5 hot seconds in a conversation with Bill O'Reilly. I would love to have a president who said, the goal of my presidency will be to take seriously the fact that U.S. foreign policy is predicated on the murder of humans, which it is. Basically, all nation states are suffering from the same problem. The U.S. is not unique in this regard. But sure, he's right. It doesn't matter that he's right, though, because what he didn't go on to say in so many words, although he will go on to show in his policy, is, but we're cool with that. And to say we should not talk smack about Putin because we're just as bad as he is not reassuring to me in any way.
But he didn't say that, though, either, because this is
He did not actually make a moral equivalence. And I do think this is the ongoing problem where people read between Trump's lines to hear the worst thing he could have said. From a public relations perspective or whatever. And that is frequently not the thing he actually said. Whether it's the thing he meant for us to read between his lines is a matter between Scott Adams and his God, I suppose.
I would add, Nick, that he's just very selective in this line of discussion. He uses it for Vladimir Putin. He doesn't use it for the leadership in Iran, for example, or China or Mexico, or even Angela Merkel. His words, he has consistently used this. And it's another weird thing where people are registering some kind of surprise or outrage. He said the exact same thing during the campaign on the exact same issue as the precursor to what he's going against the so-called judge. He was going after a so-called judge in Judge Curiel when he made a ruling that he didn't like there, too. So this is the person that we knew this behavior going in, and 62 million Americans said, all right, we're fine with that, or we're fine enough with that. So this is who he is. And I think it's more helpful to always focus on what he can actually do and is actually doing, and start treating his Twitter feed kind of like how Cubans used to treat the Fidel Castro speeches, which they'd watch on TV with a sound off and just laugh because it's super funny. his tweeting is hilarious, and his trolling is kind of in its own way hilarious. And we just have someone who acts differently as a president than we've ever seen before, and might as well enjoy the entertainment of it, and then, you know, look harder at what he's going to actually do in terms of Russian policy. Is he going to lift sanctions, even though the sanctions were applied based on the takeover of Crimea? You know, that's where the rubber hits the road on that policy. And I would just point out that the people that he's appointed to engage in this foreign policy just disagree with his characterizations or his defenses of Vladimir Putin, which is, again, pretty wild to me.
It's also interesting to think about if everywhere you read that sales of 1984, you know, have gone through the roof, Orwell's novel, and it is kind of like, you know, we've always been at war with Eurasia, which I'll say is Russia this time. But now it seems like we're making up with them as a way to kind of squeeze China as well. And there may be more geopolitical strategy going on here than people are willing to give Trump credit for, because he comes across as a complete idiot who does not think about anything, you know, more than his next taco bowl. But that we'll see. We've got actual confirmation hearings coming, or confirmation votes coming up, on Betsy DeVos for Secretary of Education and Jeff Sessions. Last week, Trump announced his first of probably at least two, maybe several Supreme Court nominations with Neil Gorsuch. The DeVos vote seems to be at 50-50. A couple of Republicans have defected. That would let Mike Pence break the tie as the imperial wizard of the Senate, or whatever it's called. Sessions seems to be somewhat in trouble, but probably will go through. Are we, Betsy DeVos, Catherine, you write a lot about education. She is by far and away the most, pro-school choice person that we have ever seen, you know, publicly. Should she get nominated, and should we care, or confirmed rather?
I am a DeVos dead ender. But I fear that it might be a dead end. I think she is a good pick. She was one of the things that made me say I will not immediately resign all hope that Trump will do anything that I like ever. The fact that she fumbled the confirmation hearing was definitely unfortunate. I think the underlying policies she would promote are good. But the main issue to me is it's looking kind of like, you know, who's going up on the altar to have their heart plucked out and eaten. And Betsy DeVos's heart just looks really juicy and delicious right now, apparently. So.
Yeah, it would be. She clearly on a certain level does not have the sort of organizational or administrative background independent of what department she would be heading. I don't think, you know, she hasn't headed beyond, like, not even we're talking about schools per se, which may or may not matter, but a large bureaucracy. But certainly her policies, they're right up Reason's alley in terms of promoting school choice.
That's a model that you can work with, right? The model of this is not a person who has the bureaucratic expertise, but they're a political appointment and they will lead in a political way. I mean, that's common. And I think it was sort of disingenuous of opponents of DeVos to say this is what disqualifies her, when what they really mean is we disagree with the way she thinks our public school dollars should be spent. Also disingenuous, the sort of demagoguing of the idea that Betsy DeVos somehow has control over the budgets of America's public schools. The federal government funds very, very little of actual public school funding. And that is something that everyone is eager to eradicate when it comes to, oh my God, she's going to fire your beloved kindergarten teacher. She can't do that.
I'm just distressed that this is where the energy has gone into the resistance, hashtag resistance in the Democratic Party. Of all places to go, it was this pick. I get that she wasn't very good in the confirmation hearings, but given the relative unimportance of her job, and also given that the importance of Jeff Sessions, and I think the increased awfulness of him, it's kind of appalling to me that they wouldn't coalesce and try to find a more winning argument against Jeff Sessions. However, they have inadvertently done us a favor in this time when there's lots of people on the streets and there's kind of a coalescing, large scale left of center resistance to Trump. That is in some ways more interesting, at least lived in on the street and in airports, than what you've seen politically among Democrats. But it's a reminder that right now the modern Democratic Party is just awful. Its priorities are just awful when it comes to what it wants to do. I mean, if Elizabeth Warren was named dictator for life, we wouldn't have school choice. That is the fact of where the Democratic Party lives right now. It cares more about teachers' unions than kids. And that is just plumb awful ideologically, but they've, I guess, done us a favor in case you were thinking that when the pendulum swings, and it will, that some great things are going to happen. I don't see it. I think we'll look back at Barack Obama and say he was the most pro school choice Democrat that we've had and will have in any foreseeable future. And that's just an awful place to be. Yeah.
What about Sessions? I mean, because, this is also an odd thing with DeVos, is that it does take some of the pressure, especially if she doesn't make it, then there's a huge kind of weight to, instead of trying to run the table against all of Trump's nominees to confirm the next one. Jeff Sessions is a longtime senator. There's, that kind of camaraderie that we supposedly hear about all the time that would make it easier. But Sessions is truly awful, right? As a as an attorney general, he was pretty good on spending issues, but he's a protectionist on trade. He's absolutely terrible on the drug war. He does not care about civil liberties in a particular way. And by most accounts, including Trump's own, he talked to Sessions about immigration. And that's when he was like, oh, I see. We really do need to seal our borders. So
And if there's anyone that you could theoretically have built a broad-based anti-Trump coalition to oppose, it should have been Sessions, right? And I assume that this is a case where people were being pragmatic. You know, it's tough to get senators to turn against their own, but he should have been the target of everyone's ire, and to instead play some sort of old school interest group politics on DeVos is clearly a missed opportunity.
Yeah, Matt, what's your favorite thing about Jeff Sessions?
That during the campaign last year, he said that Donald Trump is self-evidently appropriately tough on crime because he wanted to execute the Central Park Five. Like, he's one of us. See, he had this great idea to execute the Central Park Five.
And not Ooh, only
we're,
did
we're not guilty.
Yeah, I was
they were not
say-
guilty.
He still called for them to be executed after they were exonerated due to DNA tests.
It's appalling the extent to which people don't really grapple with or haven't prioritized that person in that job has such discretion. Of course, the federal government doesn't have unlimited resource, so it has to make discretionary calls about what it's going to emphasize as the Department of Justice. And you're going to elect a guy who has 1982 ideas about the drug war and just say no. He thinks that asset forfeiture, 95% of it is used against drug dealers, which is just patently laughable. So you're going to give that person with this much discretion, who is the intellectual architect in the Senate against immigration and has spread tons of nonsense about immigration there, he's going to be prioritizing law enforcement against immigrants. That's what's going to happen. And to choose Betsy DeVos over him as a locus point speaks to an incredible lack of seriousness and lack of ability to recognize potential allies that you could peel off in the Republican Party who are skeptical about him for similar reasons.
Well, Let's next week, let's make a pact. We do this every Monday. Let's make a pact to talk about the Democratic Party and the resistance, such as it is, and where it is really kind of falling down on the job, I think, for many reasons that you guys have both noticed. So it may never be over for the white race, but it is over for this edition of the Reason podcast. I would like to which also I'll add has at least two out of three people on this call whose ancestors may not have qualified as the white race just a mere 100 years ago. I'll let you figure out who those are. I want to thank Matt Welch, editor-at-large at Reason.
Danke.
And Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us, Catherine.
Thanks, dude.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. And while you're there, rate and review us. It helps us know what we're doing right and what we can work on. For the Reason Podcast, I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening.